Hello and welcome to The Ministry of Truth. I'm Mitchell Strapinchik. On today's show, we'll feature a radio adaptation of an essay posted on the Michael Moore website about the Democrats' reaction to the 2004 elections. We'll also include a weekly review of news relating to the intersection of media and democracy entitled Media Minutes. But first, let's hear these news briefs courtesy of The New Standard. A company fed rotten food to Abu Ghraib prisoners, sparking a rebellion. An army officer faces reduced charges in the killing of a wounded Iraqi. A Marine describes his own atrocities as part of his own case for asylum. The CIA is organizing a scheme to spy automatically on internet chat rooms. And unions organize a successful minimum wage increase in New York. To those Iraqi detainees whom guards and interrogators did not humiliate or torture last winter, along with those who they did, a private military contractor fed spoiled and rancid meals laden with dirt and bugs, according to an article published by CorpWatch, an organization that investigates war profiteering. Army Major David Dinena, a military policeman stationed at the facility, spent part of last fall trying to remedy the food situation, which he described to his superiors in an email as a contract meals disaster that led to prisoners falling violently ill after meals. A military report quoted by CorpWatch concluded that the, quote, deplorable food and living conditions, unquote, had in fact led to a prisoner uprising the army had originally blamed on a mass escape attempt. The contract company blamed for the bad food is identified as a small Qatar-based firm called American Service Center. A court-martial is set to proceed in the case of a U.S. Army captain whose execution of a wounded Iraqi civilian, Karim Hassan, was caught on video by a military helicopter, according to an Army spokesperson, Major Michael Indovina. But the accused captain's commanding officer, Major General Martin Dempsey, said the military would be dropping the original murder indictment, opting instead for lesser charges of assault with intention to commit murder, as well as dereliction of duty, carrying a combined maximum sentence of 20 and a half years. Witnesses told a hearing in Germany last September that Hassan, whom the military will refer to only as an unidentified paramilitary member, had already suffered a critical head wound when Captain Rogelio Maynoulet fired the shot that killed him. Maynoulet told 1st Lieutenant Colin Kremen that he killed Hassan out of mercy, the lieutenant testified, adding that Hassan had half his brain hanging out and killing him was definitely the humane response. According to the official version of events, Maynoulet's patrol had fired from behind on a vehicle being driven by Hassan, who was reportedly the driver of rebel cleric Muqtada al-Sadr. The original shooting, in which a passenger was also killed, does not appear to be under scrutiny. Al-Sadr was not in the vehicle at the time. At a hearing on December 9th for a U.S. soldier seeking asylum in Canada, one witness described how he and his fellow Marines routinely shot unarmed civilians at checkpoints in Iraq. "We deliberately gunned down people who were civilians," said Marine Staff Sergeant Jimmy Massey, who was honorably discharged after serving 12 years in the military, 3 months of which were in Iraq. "I became so concerned," Massey continued, "because I felt that Marines were honestly enjoying it. I saw plenty of Marines become psychopaths. They enjoyed the killing." Massey, addressing the Canadian Immigrant and Refugee Board, told of one 48-hour period when he and his fellow Marines killed over 30 civilians while they were stationed at a checkpoint in southern Baghdad. Massey said those civilians included a group of unarmed demonstrators and a driver of a car who had raised his hands above his head in surrender. The Marines deny Massey's charges. While stopping short of calling Massey a liar, a Marine spokesperson told the Associated Press, "Massey's perception of what the situation was in relation to the rules of engagement and what was justified is different from ours." He also said that an investigation found that any allegations of war crimes were unsubstantiated. The soldier whose trial at which Massey served as a witness is seeking refugee status in Canada after leaving his unit in North Carolina, just before he was about to ship out to Iraq. He had applied for conscientious objector status, but was turned down. Jeremy Hinsman is one of three fleeing American soldiers currently asking the Canadian government to grant them asylum on the grounds that they will face jail and social prosecution if they return to the U.S. Documents obtained by a public interest research center show that the Central Intelligence Agency and the National Science Foundation collaborated to fund researchers developing software to electronically spy on internet chat rooms. The documents, obtained by the Electronic Privacy Information Center, or EPIC, through a Freedom of Information Act and reviewed by the new standard, show that $157,673 was awarded to researchers Bulent Yenner and Mukai Krishnamurti to fund the development of chat room surveillance software. That document includes information about the project, conducted under the auspices of the Rensselaer Polytechnic Institute, RPI, in Troy, New York, the objective of which is described as the establishment of a fully automated surveillance system for data collection and analysis in internet chat rooms to discover hidden groups. The document further explains that surveillance will determine what is being discussed in various chat rooms, who is discussing those topics, and if the topic is hot in a particular chat room. Thus, the proposed system could aid the intelligent community, according to the document, to discover hidden communities and communication patterns in chat rooms without human intervention. The description goes on to explain that the award is supported jointly by the NSF and the intelligence community. Another document obtained by EPIC through the Freedom of Information Act is a Memorandum of Understanding between the National Science Foundation and the CIA, outlining a jointly funded research initiative to encourage long-term high-risk research approaches to scientific research in support of the nation's fight against terrorism. While the amount of money provided by the CIA to the initiative has been blanked out, the memorandum shows the National Science Foundation contributing $2.5 million in both fiscal years 2003 and 2004. The document also shows that the National Science Foundation is providing 70% of the funding, leading the new standard to extrapolate that the CIA provided an average of $1 million in each of those years. According to the CNET News, the development of the surveillance project itself has been known about for some time, but the CIA's involvement was unknown until the release of the documents. Over the objections of business interests and the governor, New York lawmakers voted to raise the state minimum wage by $2 over 2 years. Labor unions, working family advocates, and others declared victory after lobbying and demonstrating for months to get the legislation passed. Governor George Pataki had earlier vetoed the increase, but on December 10th, the state's Republican-dominated Senate followed the lead of its Democratic-dominated Assembly lead and overrode the veto. A report published this summer found that even if Congress doubled the federal minimum wage, the nation's working families would still struggle to meet basic ends. That study, by Wider Opportunities for Women, a Washington, D.C.-based organization advocating for women's economic equality, looked at 10 communities across the U.S. and found that people working full-time at $12 an hour needed a package of government supports like childcare, healthcare, and food stamps just to meet basic needs. In fact, the current minimum wage covers only 34% of basic needs in the communities studied. Additionally, a Businessweek survey based on Bureau of Labor Statistics found that if the minimum wage had risen at the same rate as CEO pay over the past 25 years, it would now be at almost $45 an hour. The New York wage hike will raise the state's current minimum of $5.15 an hour to a $6 hourly wage at the beginning of the new year. On January 1, 2006, it will increase again to $7.15 per hour. Pataki and business federations had opposed the hike, arguing that it would cause hardship for New York companies by forcing them to pay higher labor costs and putting them at a disadvantage when competing against counterparts in other states. Advocates for a living wage have argued that the government's provision of limited social benefits is essentially subsidizing corporations, allowing them to continue to pay low wages and provide little or no benefits. State lawmakers acknowledge that a federal wage raise would have been preferred, but said that they were compelled to act when one was not forthcoming. These brief reports come to us courtesy of The New Standard. We encourage you to support independent, nonprofit, anti-commercial news sources like The New Standard on the web at newstandardnews.net. You're listening to The Ministry of Truth.
Welcome to Media Minutes, a weekly review of news relating to the intersection of media and democracy. I'm John Anderson.
And I'm Kimberly Cronick.
Next year, the United States Supreme Court will hear a case that could very well determine the future of the internet as we know it. At issue is whether cable companies should open up their infrastructures to other internet service providers, or whether they can keep their natural monopoly on coax in the ground. There's a real disparity between broadband ISPs depending on their infrastructure, thanks to an arbitrary classification made by the FCC 2 years ago. Phone companies that offer DSL service are classified as telecommunication services and therefore have to allow competitors onto their networks. But cable modem broadband service is classified as an information service and therefore can stay closed to competitors. But a federal district court ruled that since the service provided by DSL and cable modems is essentially identical, the regulatory difference between them is wholly artificial, and cable systems should be open to such competition. The Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals upheld that ruling twice. If the Supreme Court overturns the lower courts and prohibits competition on cable systems, there's a real fear that phone companies will ask for the same protections, which would stymie the growth of broadband services and almost certainly lead to increased prices. In addition, if cable companies are determined to have unique control over their networks, it could open the door for corporate censorship or other forms of content discrimination. One worst-case scenario predicts broadband cable providers could charge customers variable rates depending on the kind of information they look for or download.
In late November, Congress approved a $388 billion spending bill that included several last-minute amendments. One such amendment created a federal copyright enforcement officer to coordinate anti-piracy government projects. Gigi Sohn, president of Public Knowledge, a public watchdog on issues of copyright, says the original version of this particular legislation was much worse. It would have essentially turned the Justice Department into a police force for the movie and music industries. The modified program places the government's copyright czar in the Department of Commerce, which Sohn believes is a much more public-friendly environment for copyright-related issues.
Most of the copyright policy in this country right now is done by either the Congress or the Copyright Office. And both Congress and the Copyright Office are very beholden to the interests of the content industry. The Commerce Department, on the other hand, has been far more skeptical of the copyright agenda of the Foxes, Disneys, and Time Warners. A lot of what this role is going to have to do with is physical piracy issues, which are far bigger issues for the content industry than peer-to-peer file trading.
Just who this new copyright czar might be and when they will begin work remains a mystery.
I would urge the government to look for somebody who hasn't already worked for one of the affected companies, and somebody who is about as a neutral arbiter as possible.
Sohn and other public interest advocates working on intellectual property issues in D.C. recognize and understand the need for copyright law, but she wonders if it enjoys a higher profile than it deserves.
Given all the other problems that the government has with terrorism, with education, with health care, this is an interesting thing to put taxpayer dollars towards.
The copyright czar gets an initial budget of $2 million with which to work. That's just 10% of what the original enforcement plan called for.
And now, here's a Media Minutes Fast Fact. The 2004 election cycle set a new record for the amount of money dumped into TV advertising. This is a record that seems to be broken every electoral cycle. Candidates and special interests spent $1.6 billion on political ads this year, according to the Alliance for Better Campaigns. And these figures only count the spending done in the top 100 media markets. Millions more got spent in smaller markets, especially in those swing states. Even with this partial total, that's more than double the amount spent in 2000. This definitely hurt political news coverage as well. An analysis by the Norman Lear Center Local News Archive at the University of Southern California found that in swing states, every half-hour newscast on average contained nearly 6 minutes of political advertising, but only 3 minutes of actual campaign-related news. You've been listening to Media Minutes, a joint production of the Illinois Initiative for Media Policy Research at the University of Illinois Urbana-Champaign and Free Press, a national nonpartisan organization dedicated to media democracy. For more information, visit our website at freepress.net.
This is the Ministry of Truth. I'm Mitchell Stripinchik. On today's show, we'll feature a radio adaptation of an essay reposted on the Michael Moore website, www.michaelmoore.com. The essay is written by Mel Giles, who worked as an advocate of victims of domestic abuse and who noted many parallels between her advocacy work and the reactions of many Democrats to the 2004 election results. Here's what she had to say. Watch Dan Rather apologize for not getting his facts straight, humiliated before the eyes of America, voluntarily undermining his credibility and career of over 30 years. Observe Donna Brazile squirm as she is ridiculed by Babe Buchanan and pronounced irrelevant and nearly non-existent. Listen as Donna and Nancy Pelosi and Senator Charles Schumer take to the airwaves saying that they have to go back to the drawing board and learn from their mistakes and try to be better, more likable, more appealing, have a stronger message, speak to morality. Watch them awkwardly quote the Bible, trying to speak the new language of America. Surf the blogs and read the comments of the dismayed, discombobulated, confused individuals trying to figure out what they did wrong. Hear the cacophony of voices crying out, "Why did they beat me?" And then ask anyone who has ever worked in a domestic violence shelter if they have heard this before. They will tell you every single day. The answer is quite simple. They beat us because they are abusers. We can call it hate. We can call it fear. We can say it is unfair. But we are looped into the cycle of violence, and we need to start calling the dominating side what they are: abusive. And we need to recognize that we are the victims of verbal, mental, and even, in the case of Iraq, physical violence. As victims, we can't stop asking ourselves what we did wrong. We can't seem to grasp that they will keep hitting us and beating us as long as we keep sticking around and asking ourselves what we are doing to deserve the beating. Listen to George Bush say that the will of God excuses his behavior. Listen as he refuses to take responsibility, or express remorse, or even once admit a mistake. Watch him strut and tell us that he will only work with those who agree with him, and that each of us is only allowed one question. Soon it will be none at all. Abusers hit hard when questioned. The press corps can tell you that. See him surround himself with only those who pledge oaths of allegiance. Hear him tell us that if we will only listen and do as he says and agree with his every utterance, all will go well with us. It won't. We will never be worthy. And watch the Democratic Party leadership walk on eggshells. Try to meet him. Please him. Wash the windows better. Get out that spot. Distance themselves from gays and civil rights. See the Democrats cry for the attention and affection and approval of the president and his followers. Watch us squirm. Watch us descend into a world of crazy-making where logic does not work and the other side tells us we are nuts when we rely on facts. A world where, worst of all, we begin to believe we are crazy. How do we break free? Again, the answer is quite simple. First, you must admit that you are a victim. Then you must declare the state of affairs unacceptable. Next, you must promise to protect yourself and everyone around you that is being victimized. You don't do this by responding to their demands, or becoming more like them, or engaging in logical conversation, or trying to persuade them that you are right. You also don't do this by going catatonic and resigned, by closing up your ears and eyes and covering your head and submitting to the blows, figuring it's over faster and hurts less if you don't resist and fight back. Instead, you walk away. You find other folks like yourself, 57 million of them, who are hurting, broken, and beating themselves up. You tell them what you've learned and that you aren't going to take it anymore. You stand tall with 57 million people at your side and behind you. And you look right into the eyes of the abuser and you tell him to go to hell. Then you walk out the door, taking the kids and gays and minorities with you, and you start a new life. The new life is hard, but it's better than the abuse. We have a mandate to be as radical and liberal and steadfast as we need to be. The progressive beliefs and social justice we stand for, our core, must not be altered. We are 57 million strong. We are building from the bottom up. We are meeting on the net, in church basements, at work, in small groups, and right now we are crying because we are trying to break free and we don't know how. Any battered woman in America, any oppressed person around the globe who has defied her oppressor will tell you this. There is nothing wrong with you. You are in good company. You are safe. You are not alone. You are strong. You must change only one thing. Stop responding to the abuser. Don't let him dictate the terms or frame the debate. He'll win, not because he's right, but because force works. Sure, we can build a better grassroots campaign, cultivate and raise up better leaders, reform the election system to make it fail-proof, stick to our message, learn from the strategy of the other side. But we absolutely must dispense with the notion that we are weak, godless, cowardly, disorganized, crazy, too liberal, naive, amoral, loose, irrelevant, outmoded, stupid, and soon to be extinct. We have the mandate of the world to back us, and the legacy of oppressed peoples throughout history. Even if you do everything right, they'll hit you anyway. Look at the poor souls who voted for this nonsense. They are working for $6 an hour if they are working at all. Their children are dying overseas and suffering from lack of health care and a depleted environment and a shoddy education. And they don't even know they are being hit. You're listening to the Ministry of Truth.